One, hold the paper up. One, two, three.
You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, December 16th, 2013. My name is Matt Binder.
I'm Michael Brooks.
And this is the award-winning The Majority Report. We are broadcasting to you live in the literal but not metaphorical shadow of the New York Times building.
In the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City, I'm Matt and Mike Monday.
That's what this is.
On this brutal December day, it's incredibly cold here in New York City. I'm going to be talking with Michelle Goldberg, senior writer at The Nation magazine, on the GOP's poverty denialism and their abandonment of cultural populism and what that all means for poverty in America, the inequality crisis. Also going to be talking about the Pope responding to accusations of Marxism in a way that is making me think for the first time that maybe he's actually a Marxist. Well, I'm just kidding, but it was a very entertaining response. Also, Chris Christie shows more cynical short-term thinking, leaves a global warming pact that has been a huge success across the Northeast. Rush Limbaugh brings us back to our little friend from last week, Patrick Howley, with some new theories on women liking to be stared at. We'll get to that.
60 Minutes does a hard-hitting, a fantastic piece of journalism on the NSA and Edward Snowden. They basically do a piece that says, NSA really are the good guys. Watch out. Don't let Edward Snowden fool you.
Their rooms are cool.
Yeah, they got pretty cool rooms.
They have, like, big computer screens.
Yeah.
Did you know that, like,
General Alexander's a nice guy. He was really nice to me.
Yeah.
He offered me some sweet tea.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. I feel so bad for, the people who produced the show on Benghazi. So let's try to take heat off of them by making an even more embarrassing piece of programming.
What, some other e-commerce website doesn't have a piece of telemarketing to provide for us this week? Well, I guess we got to go with this NSA story.
Yeah, we'll do that.
We
Amazon
also
Zone story was cool, but today we just, these NSA guys are just awesome.
We also have an update on the story that has taken America by storm this past week. Megyn Kelly saying Santa Claus is a white guy. Period.
Period.
No ifs, ends, or buts. You can't change that. Don't tell me this fictional character isn't white.
To all concerned, precocious 5-year-olds watching Fox, who
and
are
she
deeply
very,
racist.
She has a great response where she basically apologizes, takes the heat, and really, you know, looks at herself in the mirror. Nah, that didn't happen either. We'll get
more
to that.
Sorry, I'm not sorry. Response
not,
from
not
Megyn Kelly.
Not even that. You're giving her too much credit.
I'm the victim here. Pretty stunning, pretty unpleasant. I don't know if we'll get to this, but we do want to just mention that I believe it was last Friday or Thursday, an errant drone strike in Yemen killed.
Oh, I'm getting to that.
Okay,
we'll get
to this story. A horrible story of people on their way to a wedding in Yemen killed by a drone strike. Matt, we'll get to that. Obviously, the North Korean leader had his uncle executed. Hopefully, people don't take that as any inspiration for their holiday season.
Protests in Ukraine continue to erupt. We really got to find someone and We'll have someone on for
that. We will get to that.
We've been looking at a few names. We're going to get someone on for that.
We'll get to the Chris Christie traffic jam scandal. We'll get to, Bill de Blasio is named Bill Bratton as police commissioner. So a lot we'll get to, but we just wanted to mention. We'll be right back. We're going to take a brief break, and we'll be come right back with Michelle Goldberg on GOP poverty denialism. This is the Majority Report. Be right back.
And them say, here comes trouble, here comes the danger, sent by the Savior, welcome the Rasta youths. I and I start recruit, soldiers for Selassie army, aye. Here comes trouble, here comes the danger, welcome the Savior, welcome the Rasta youths. You're not for axes who are the general issue in a warning. Job people, them a ball, said them tired of mediocre. Evil a go fall when we tried in Ethiopia. Believing from down, call them life no easy boat. Even Bantan said it's not an easy road. Operation, occupy the motherland. Calling all soldiers to kind each other along. From creation, he writing a job plan, but chronics can't do it alone. So I'm recruiting soldiers coming from near and far, I choose. Executing Selassie I works and the Rastafari troops. And them say, here comes trouble, here comes the danger, sent by the Savior, welcome the Rasta youths. I'm gonna start recruit soldiers for Selassie I army, aye. Here comes trouble, here comes the danger, welcome the Savior, welcome the Rasta youths. You're not for axes who are the general issue in a warning poll. Waving the banner red, green and gold. It is such a honor prophecies unfold. Discovered on stones and trees and scrolls. And even in the stories that Jesus told. Rasta youth must inherit the earth. Can't sit down, Jaja send me for work. Bring the fire in a room, Jaja send me for purge. But I can't do it alone. Rasta recruiting soldiers coming from near and far, I choose. Executing Selassie I works and be lost afar, I choose. Here comes trouble, here comes the danger, sent by the Savior, welcome the Rasta youths. I and I start recruit soldiers for Selassie I army, aye. Here comes trouble, here comes
we the are danger. Back on the Majority Report. The Savior, my name is Matt Binder.
And I am Michael Brooks, and joining us now is Michelle Goldberg. She's a senior contributing writer at The Nation magazine. Michelle, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you on. So you've been writing recently a really interesting series of pieces on, I guess, between the kind of, first of all, I think connecting the right's social conservatism with its economic policies and not kind of allowing the narrative that those two things are sort of separate propositions, which we hear a lot, particularly when people talk about the Tea Party. And you've also been talking about this kind of shifting rhetoric on the right about poverty and in terms of how they relate to a kind of cultural populism, which they has definitely been part of their kind of modern rise and coalition building in some respects. And I'm wondering, you wrote a review of a woman named Charlotte Hayes who has a new book, and the title is Did White Trash Become the New Normal? A Southern Lady Asked the Impertinent Question. And I'm just wondering if you could tell us about that book. It already sounds incredible.
Yeah, It's this kind of vicious little book that maybe wouldn't be worth writing about on its own, except for the fact that, first of all, this is a relatively well-known writer, the founder of the Independent Women's Forum, which is, you know, a well-known anti-feminist organization. It's published by a prominent conservative imprint, Regnery. And it's also fascinating as an example of what I see as this shift away from the sort of right-wing populist rhetoric that we've all gotten used to over the last decade, or even more than the last decade. You know, Thomas Frank wrote a whole great book, What's the Matter with Kansas, about the attempt by Republicans, the successful attempt by Republicans to kind of wrap themselves up in the iconography of the middle American everyman. You know, NASCAR and barbecues and tractors, and as opposed to those kind of effete liberals on the coast. Whereas this book is a broadside against, you know, basically against the lower middle, the poor and the lower middle class. She talks, I mean, she goes on and on about obesity, about diabetes as a white trash disease. She, you know, at one point, I'll just read you this one line, which I think, or two lines, which I think are kind of give you the flavor of the book. We look like hell as a nation, and fat people bear a large brunt of responsibility for this. I can remember when going to New York that seeing beautiful, pencil-thin people in stylish clothes on Fifth Avenue. Where are they now? The other day I saw a fat guy in polyester in my favorite New York restaurant. Now, this is, you know, maybe this is a very, very different tone than we're used to hearing from the right. This is kind of a much more nakedly aristocratic tone.
Right. This almost seems like she is like on retainer to express Mitt Romney's id or something. But like,
well, and I, yeah,
go ahead. Yeah.
Well, what I think, you know, I think that that 47% thing is the kind of thing that Republicans maybe, or we all used to assume that that conservatives said behind closed doors, and the 47% gave us proof that that's what they said behind closed doors. But this, but I also think it's evidence of something broader. You know, I was Charles Murray's new book about
right.
White America, or newish book about white America. It obviously doesn't speak in the same kind of viciously sneering tone, but it's very, but it makes kind of similar points about basically calling poor people. He talks about how the real problem behind inequality is what he calls a quote decay in industriousness among working class white men, as opposed to a decay in labor market. And again, I think you haven't seen these sort of attacks on the white working class. I mean, maybe you've seen them in policy, but you haven't seen them rhetorically from the Republican Party and from the conservative movement before.
No, absolutely. And I think, and so this is really fascinating because, you know, Charles Murray, of course, is pretty infamous, I think, still for writing The Bell Curve, I believe it was called. I mean, that book came out when, even, you know, certainly even before I went to high school, but he wrote a book in the mid 90s basically saying, this is no exaggeration, this is a straight representation of the book, that it basically on average African Americans are intellectually inferior. That explains gaps in achievement, poverty, and access. And this was kind of like the, you know, some people ran away from it, but it definitely was in the milieu of things like welfare reform and the kind of Republican assault on government programs that were at least branded as catering to minorities. So and then there was the contrast with this kind of assault on the minorities with a kind of certain type of cultural populism, white working class populism that Thomas Frank wrote about. What's happening now to push Republicans to take that same vicious and disingenuous approach that they used on African Americans, Hispanics, women, and now kind of throw it, it seems to me, like at a pretty essential part of their electoral base?
Well, I mean, I can't explain it politically, but I think, you know, and these are writers, these aren't political strategists. So I think where it's coming kind of intellectually, if you want to use that word, is that welfare reform happened, you know, so you no longer kind of have people who are luxuriating on, even the stereotype becomes harder to sustain in the absence of the availability of kind of long-term welfare. So when we talk about welfare now, when we talk about social spending, we're talking about things like unemployment insurance, which we're having a big fight about right now. We're talking about cuts in food stamps. You know, we just had a 7% cut in food stamps after a lot of kind of political debate. And these are programs that largely help the working poor. You know, you don't get unemployment insurance unless you had a job pretty recently. And you don't, a majority of the people on food stamps either are working right now or were working recently. And so if you want to explain, again, if you want to kind of explain why these programs are counterproductive, are encouraging laziness and vice, which tends to be the Republican line, then you kind of have to go after the people who actually take advantage of them. And it's increasingly hard, I think, to do that in simply racial terms.
Right, and it's also you're absolutely right, of course, that these are writers, but, you know, we have, you know, Mitt Romney, obviously 47% was a blunder, and he said it in a private setting, but nonetheless, he said it. You know, Paul Ryan has said very similar things. There's been endless commentary on food stamps, including, I remember, one rep, which we covered. I don't remember what state he was from, but he kind of complained about seeing people who were physically fit online at a supermarket using food stamps. So this has kind of bled much more broadly into Republican, you know, as you would say, quote, intellectual life and also politics. But then you also point out in some of your other writing that the paradox of this is that at the same time, they also want to really hit Obama hard and Democrats hard on, you know, what I think objectively is still a pretty anemic economy. A slower recovery, a lot of pretty, you know, poor-paying jobs, and a pretty broad lack of availability. So they are in the position of kind of both saying, hey, look, the economy is not where it needs to be. Unemployment is too high. And then at the same time, there's this kind of omni-employment availability that's just not being utilized because people are lazy and stupid.
Right. Well, I mean, that's what I find amazing. And I've written before what to me is maybe the most amazing thing, if you want to kind of see how much contempt they have for the poor people, look at the fact that they kind of can't even really be roused to blame their poverty on Obama. You know, so you basically, you have a situation where Republicans believe simultaneously that Obama has destroyed the economy and eviscerated the job market, and that the unemployed are lazy and just need to be kind of given a kick in the pants to go out and get all of these available jobs. And I think they're rarely asked to kind of account for the fact that they hold these two beliefs simultaneously.
Yeah, I mean, so they're not only are they kind of asked to account for it, but is there, I mean, do you see a danger for them electorally and in their positioning as they kind of, they make these assertions and they're talking about people that they've relied on votes for? Or, and this I think maybe connects with a thread that you've also connected really well, where you've kind of talked about, I think maybe a while ago, like even a decade ago or so, or, you know, it seemed less connected at a certain point. It always was connected formally, but the kind of social conservatism and the kind of extreme economic views that people still even like to talk about them as like discrete categories. Like, oh, you know, Tea Party people.
Those have always been intertwined.
Right.
You know, a balanced budget amendment was one of the main legislative priorities of the Christian coalition in the 1990s.
Right.
You know, these are, and they're intertwined kind of not just tactically, but intellectually. Because, I mean, essentially, conservatives believe that people should rely for their social welfare on their families and their churches. Mm-hmm. And that it's only when there's a breakdown in those structures that they need to rely on government. And to be honest, to some extent, they are not totally wrong. Like, if you look at countries that do have very rich social welfare states, you know, Scandinavia, Iceland, women are less dependent on men for their social welfare, and so more likely to become single mothers. You know, if basically your choice is kind of marry or starve, that'll shore up the institution, potentially shore up the institution of marriage. And so, you know, they are correct that an expanded social welfare state could, although I should say they're correct to a certain extent, because at the same time, you know, we all know that marriage is increasingly becoming, you know, kind of the preserve of the upper middle class that tend to have much more stable social arrangements.
Right.
But basically, again, they kind of believe that the expanding welfare state is both a cause and a consequence of family breakdown.
So, and do you think that though there's also another kind of, and I think we encounter a lot of libertarians on this show, particularly like younger libertarians, and I'm wondering if it seems to me that there's a part of, we assume that all of this kind of attack on people for being lazy or not getting where they need to be, that, you know, it makes intuitive sense that you're not going to respond well to somebody who's attacking you and saying that you're terrible, right? But it also seems that there are some people that almost buy into that message. Like, they look at this climate and they think, no, it really is because I'm not good enough. I'm not kind of, succeeding in the proper way or fully fulfilling my potential or exerting myself. So do you think that there's another way in which they're also just trying to kind of formalize a certain narrative within people and as individuals even of, you know, if it's a problem, it's my problem, period?
I mean, whether or not they're kind of consciously trying to tap into that, I can't say. I do think it's pretty clear that, you know, we all know that long-term unemployment is connected with, you know, kind of depression and loss of self-esteem and loss of self-respect. And the reason for that is because people blame themselves for these things. And, you know, no matter kind of how aware they are of the broader social forces, it's hard not to wonder, you know, why me? I think this is something, for example, that feminists are very, very aware of. You know, no matter how aware you are of kind of male privilege and sexism, when you're passed over for something, it's hard to kind of discern, is it sexism or do I just suck?
Right.
And so, yeah, I do think that, you know, that a lot of people are very, very insecure about these things. You know, and I also think it's possible that it's also just easy for people to hear these messages and tell themselves that they're talking about somebody else.
Uh-huh. I need
these benefits. You know, I need these benefits. I earned these benefits, not like all those other lazy people who are just, sitting on their butts and kind of collecting checks.
Right. That was like Chris Rock had a routine about the people listening to certain lyrics in a song and saying, "Hey, it's not talking about me." So I see what you're saying. Do you think though that? Because obviously in parallel to this, there's definitely a much broader discourse about inequality, kind of shrinking living standards. There's the fast food workers striking. There was the message that Bill de Blasio won on, you know, becoming mayor of New York. President Obama said that inequality is, you know, his sort of premier priority right now. That's definitely at least a rhetorical shift. Do you think that this maybe, I think you actually said, in contrast to the welfare era when the poor were demonized and there was this perception of lazy people who needed to kind of, you know, as you said before, like be kicked and forced into the labor market or whatever. And now that there's such a broader experience of people who work full time but are still in poverty or people who are, you know, just more kind of broadly touched by these issues, does that open the opportunity for us to actually start to rethink what poverty is and how we want to deal with it?
I really, really hope so. I mean, I think that for a long time, Democrats have been very reluctant to speak about poverty. You know, something that Obama clearly cares about poverty. It's kind of where he got started as an organizer, but it's something that he spoke about very, very little during his campaigns. You know, everything is about the middle class, the middle class, the middle class. And for a long time, I think that's because there was so much resentment about welfare. There was so much resentment about kind of the social safety net that Democrats have really, really shied away from these issues. But again, kind of given the fact that we have so many, so many of the poor in this country are the working poor, you know, kind of given the persistence of income inequality, given the economy, and given the fact that, as you said, you know, so many Americans will either spend time in poverty in their lives or know people who are in poverty in their lives. I do think that there is a huge opportunity for politicians who will speak kind of more passionately and forthrightly about this stuff.
Yeah, do you think maybe actually there might be possibly a parallel between, I think actually back to how the Democrats were approaching social issues like reproductive rights and reproductive access and also, certainly marriage equality. And there was this period where it was very trendy, probably between 2004, 2008, to, you know, how do we kind of ameliorate ourselves on these issues? What are the ways of sort of, you know, like Bill Clinton would say, safe, legal, and rare, and this type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
In 2012, and moving forward, it just is like, no, that we support access to reproductive rights, period. And that's connected to women's health, equal opportunity, and all the other things that, you know, supposedly we're supposed to be backing. I mean, do you think maybe that kind of like the issues around poverty could kind of track that same thing where it goes from an apology? Yeah.
I think that I actually think it's a little bit different mm-hmm. because, I mean, one of the things that you see with gay marriage, for example, is a huge shift among elites,
yeah.
Republican and Democratic elites.
Definitely.
And, you know, there's nothing kind of redistributive about gay marriage. You know, one of the things that makes the gay marriage issue seem like such a no-brainer and it seems kind of so breathtaking that anybody could oppose it is because it literally costs people who oppose it nothing and doesn't affect them in any way whatsoever.
Right.
Whereas when you talk about kind of change, you know, when you talk about tackling inequality, when you talk about changing the tax structure and the system of incentives in this country, you really are talking about redistribution, which, you know, is going to necessarily be a harder sell, I think, among elites.
Absolutely. I mean, so how much of the what sort of combination of that process then do you think is going to be like activating and speaking to the constituencies of working class people, middle class people, poor people, and really delivering and having a conversation with the elites where there's more of a sense about maybe, you know, ensuring social cohesion, faith in institutions, the type of kind of appeals that have maybe made the elite more receptive to those types of policies in the past?
I mean, you know, if I knew that, I would be a political, consultant instead of a journalist. I do think that, you know, I think that there's a couple of issues there. One is that you have to have you need to kind of break through the conventional wisdom among elites that our biggest long-term problem is entitlements mm-hmm. as opposed to debt and kind of attack this really unhealthy fixation on the debt. And I also think that you won't probably see much change in the absence of a large, visible, angry,
Definitely.
Organized social movement because, you know, you're saying that kind of you need these measures to, you know, protect social cohesion, which is correct. But the only way that you kind of convince people of that is by showing that there is
not social
widespread
cohesion.
Mobilized outrage.
Yeah. Right. Not social cohesion. Absolutely. Yeah. Michelle Goldberg, thank you so much for joining us today. I recommend that everybody read Michelle's pieces on this in The Nation, including the GOP's poverty denialism and many other pieces tracking these. You also just had something up, I think, on whether or not de Blasio can deliver on affordable housing, which is also really interesting. I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Well, there it is, folks. What should we do here? Should we take a break, get to another few stories?
Sure. Let's do. Well, we don't need to take you want to switch for a story? Yeah, let's switch.
Okay, we'll take a brief switch.
Let's play some Mission Impossible.
We always do the Mission Impossible. Let's do the Mission Impossible.
Oh, very nice.
All right, we'll be right back.
Chicken, but Herbert Hoover, he forgot. be sure to bring the missus too. We got no turkey for our stuffing.
All right, we are back. What I always love about, you know, this talking about your interview, Michael, with Michelle, what I always love is how
tell me
how they just don't seem to Republicans just don't seem to care about airing these things in public anymore. It
no,
used to be behind closed doors.
No, I thought that
but,
was
but now they're just coming out with it. They don't even care anymore.
Yeah, and you know what I might actually add, I think she's totally right in terms of what needs to happen and in terms of Republicans airing these things out in public. But I also think it's not just – it's the kind of pseudo-fake independent crowd
yes.
saying more of this stuff as well. And the question is what gets done with this? Is it people really see what's coming at them, or do they buy into it and rationalize it? So, I think there's a lot of interesting stuff there.
Agreed. Right. What should we get to?
I think you should get.
I think we should do the NSA story that 60 Minutes did. Yes,
this is.
It's pretty amazing. It's pretty amazing. Yes. So last night, 60 Minutes, the bastion. Oh, well, they used to be a good journalistic outfit on CBS, and recently though their quality's dropped just a tad, wouldn't you say so? Just a tad.
Oh, just slightly.
First of all, we had the story that Lara Logan did, where they talked to someone who told the truth about Benghazi.
Can you say Lara Logan again?
Lara Logan.
Yeah,
Lara.
I did a little like Scott Brown. Schwarzenegger.
Oh, there we go. So
Lara Logan.
So it turned out that this guy who was telling his first-hand account of Benghazi was just lying. His story did not match up with what he told the U.S. government, and the truth came out. And it just so happened to be that he wrote a book for CBS's one of CBS's print outfits that was coming out.
Conservative imprint.
Yeah,
I forgot which one.
So that was just an interesting little flub there, I would say. And then just before Black Friday, they had that story where Amazon was planning to unveil delivery drones. Which was interesting because there's no way these delivery drones are anywhere near being used practically. You will not be getting a drone delivery anytime soon. So it was just interesting that they chose to just take this Amazon-produced video and run with that.
From the terrible to the irrelevant, but both product placements.
Both product placements. Well,
both product
placements. Well, this is a product placement too.
Yes, exactly.
For the NSA.
There you go.
So basically, 60 Minutes decided that, according to them, the NSA wasn't doing such a good job with telling their side of the story with the Edward Snowden leaks. So they put together this piece, and, it was presented by John Miller, who has an interesting background. Let 60 Minutes tell you up front. It's, that first part one.
No U.S. intelligence agency has ever been under the kind of pressure being faced by the National Security Agency after details of some of its most secret programs were leaked by contractor Edward Snowden. Perhaps because of that pressure, the agency gave 60 Minutes unprecedented access to NSA headquarters.
Pause it. They didn't just give 60 Minutes unprecedented access to their headquarters. They specifically approached 60 Minutes and asked them to do this story on them.
We were able to speak to employees who have never spoken publicly before. Full disclosure, I once worked in the office of the Director of National Intelligence, where I saw firsthand how secretly the NSA operates.
Wow.
Full disclosure, don't take anything I'm about to say seriously.
Yeah, full disclosure. Yeah. I have a very specific side on this issue. Just unbelievable. It's also important to note that John Miller, according to a reliable source, the New York Post is reporting that 99.4% done deal that John Miller is going to be the top counterterrorism or intelligence role in the NYPD. So this guy is deep within the intelligence community. And here he is supposed to be doing the story on the Snowden leaks and the NSA for 60 Minutes. A journalistic story. The interview pretty much went as you would expect it. Let's hear part two on how John Miller describes Edward Snowden. Let's just take a listen.
This happened on your watch.
Talking to Keith Alexander.
A 20-something-year-old high school dropout contractor managed to walk out with, in essence, the crown jewels.
Oh, Edward Snowden is just a 20-something-year-old high school dropout. Well, let me tell you something about this 20-something-year-old high school dropout. He was literally weeks away from turning 30 when he leaked this material. Would you be hearing this if he was 30 when he leaked this material? I'm actually gonna say probably, because they're trying to discredit him here. But somehow him being young, which not even, I mean, 29, 30 years old. I mean, we have arguments right now where people are saying, oh, 26-year-old is a child under Obamacare. Oh, but a 29-year-old turning 30-year-old is some sort of kid when we're talking about, his outlook on civil liberties. So this, and then high school dropout, trying to discredit him because he's a high school dropout. Like, that somehow means something. He was obviously qualified to work for the NSA. They go on later to actually say he cheated on his test. No, and that's how he got hired. Hold on. That's how he got hired. If he was smart enough to cheat on his test, if that's true, and fool the NSA into hiring him, I think being a high school dropout is really doesn't even matter. What were you going to say, Michael?
No, I was just going to say that in most of these places, including Silicon Valley and places like this, they don't, the point is performance and whether or not you can do something. They don't have the same type of credential obsession that many other places had. And if you read profiles of this,
oh, yeah.
You
great
know
point.
That Edward Snowden is not the only person in these places who may or may not have either just a high school diploma or a high school equivalency.
Oh, it's a great point.
Totally irrelevant.
Yeah. I mean, you have these startup like incubators.
Absolutely.
Paying people 18, 19 to not go to college, to drop out of college. Literally hundreds of thousands of dollars to not go to college and try to start some tech business.
I mean, if their point is that the NSA hires people who can't handle high school, I don't know what their point is. Are they trying to criticize the NSA? It's ridiculous. And it's also a disgusting thing to use against people.
Oh, for sure.
All right. Go ahead.
So the 60 Minutes story continues. General Keith Alexander, who's the NSA director, says how the NSA is defending our civil liberties and privacy, which, I mean, where's the laugh track here? Because that's basically what you play. I mean, come on now.
Laugh track not playing?
Put the 360 up.
360 is up.
That's, all right, well, whatever. It's
you
not playing.
You just had a sand moment right there.
All right, well, it's not playing.
No,
so anyway, story continues where... on hearing about defending our civil liberties and privacy, you know, Miller just lets him say that without even questioning, you know, everything that they do. That goes into direct, goes directly against what he says.
It's like having a sit down with the CEO of McDonald's and let him say that he produces a health food product.
We sell salad.
We sell health food.
We sell salad.
Yeah.
Yeah. Again, the NSA talks about how Alexander, discussing the NSA, talks about how the NSA only collects phone metadata, only phone metadata, which doesn't reveal all that much, he says, even though that's not true. It tells you who you called, when you called them, your location when calling them, how many times you've called them. I mean, it's really simple to connect the dots when you have this information in bulk.
Well, and also that's exactly the point.
Yes.
They need to decide, is it pretty much nothing, in which case why do you need to do all of this drastic overreach to get it, or is it something pretty substantial, which is obviously what it is, in which case it's not nothing. Make up your mind.
They also Miller also neglects to mention the email metadata.
That's right.
The Snowden attack continued with on top of him having to cheat on the test and being a high school dropout, they talk about
By the way, completely unproven. I mean, that's just important to realize. That's pure speculation.
Yes.
I have not heard that reported really before.
Well, anyway, after discussing how private of a organization the NSA is and how they deal with all the secret information in there, they got to do all this stuff in privacy. It's very, very, very private information they're dealing with. They go on to mock Edward Snowden because apparently when he would work from home on his computer, he would put a hood over the computer and over his head so that his girlfriend or anyone at his house can't see what he was doing. Miller says how that's pretty strange. I mean, they just discussed how private and this information is and how it's top secret information they're dealing with and how there's serious ramifications if this information got into the wrong hands. And then they're mocking him for taking steps to make sure that this information was for his eyes
only. Well, I mean, obviously, if he didn't do it, then the narrative would be he was reckless with information in front of his girlfriend.
I mean, again, yes. It just went on and on and on. General Alexander discussed how there might have been a cyber attack that came from China. But again, there might have. There may or may not have happened. And how the NSA potentially saved us from this attack that may or may not have happened.
Well, but even that, the point being that is a much more legitimate, totally legitimate thing for the NSA to be doing. What does that have to do, really, with a massive metadata surveillance program? That is exactly the type of thing they could do without bulk collection of people's electronic data.
For sure.
So that's just exactly the type of smoke that they'll put out to distract from the issue.
So, I mean, you might be wondering, you know, okay, John Miller was presenting this information. He did all the interviews and everything. Perhaps, you know, there were some producers that, you know, were trying to work on making this a little bit less, you know, NSA good, Snowden bad type of material here. But oddly enough, CBS posts this behind-the-scenes report titled, How Did 60 Minutes get into the NSA's headquarters to do this piece, which, again, I'd like to mention, the NSA specifically asked 60 Minutes, hey, can you do a piece on us and try to, you know, make us look good because we're doing a terrible job at it. So they put this piece up, and they talk about how there was this crew of people called Minders who were following around every single person in the 60 Minutes crew and were there for every single person the 60 Minutes interviewed, and they would stop the interviews and tell them that they can't say that, change the subject, and how General Alexander would call timeouts and then look over to them and they would have to change the subject, which John Miller thought was pretty cool, actually. He was really, you know, wow, this is tough.
I love calling timeouts when I'm hanging out with friends.
Yeah, this is great.
Timeout.
But going back to what I was saying about the producers, they also spoke to some of the producers of 60 Minutes. And they had some interesting things to say. So you know that this wasn't, you know, all just one-sided. They had to have put someone who might have, you know, been a little bit critical of what the NSA was doing. One of those producers have to be it.
It wasn't all softball.
There had to have been some hard-hitting questions, and maybe they just didn't make it into the piece that we saw. Who knows? But let's listen to some of the producers and find out. This one is a producer. Let's listen to that.
This is an agency that really is under the gun. I'm Ira Rosen, producer of the story, and Gabriel Chandra is co-producer of the story. They have basically allowed this kid, who is now in Moscow with 1.7 million classified documents, they've allowed him to become the hero and they to become the villain.
Wow. And we have to change that. We have to reverse those roles here at 60 Minutes. Edward Snowden isn't a kid. And then he says Moscow, you know, a little snicker. And then he says how, you know, the media has been portraying this as, you know, journalists have been portraying this as Edward Snowden is some hero, which they haven't. I don't know what he's been reading. And that the NSA is some villain. Well, maybe they've done some things to come across as villainous.
Indeed.
But they have a pretty awesome
Star Trek room.
Let's continue.
We walked into a couple of rooms that just looked like they were completely out of Star Trek.
My favorite room was the Black Chamber.
These are the producers of 60 Minutes. Man, this looks like Star Trek. My favorite room was the Black Chamber. Whoa! They were doing a piece on a top secret government agency who's had material leaked by a contractor they were paying, who previously worked directly under them, who was worried about the way this agency was handling the privacy of Americans and foreigners even. And 60 Minutes was called in to do a piece by the NSA themselves. This access that I don't believe many, if any, have ever had before. And they decided to not push the envelope as any good journalists would do. And actually look into this. Let's see.
They didn't even bring an envelope.
Exactly.
There was nothing.
There was no envelope. There was nothing. They brought someone who previously worked for National Intelligence, who has ties within the intelligence community, who obviously feels for the NSA and poor, poor Keith General Alexander. And they put producers in there who, if they don't share these feelings explicitly, certainly think the NSA is doing something pretty cool.
Who has a rad black room.
Yeah, they had some cool black chamber room. They had a Star Trek, man.
60 Minutes has done us a favor.
Live long and prosper. It's unbelievable. This 60 Minutes used to do actual journalism. Before my time, I've read about it.
It was before, yeah. I mean, I remember, you know, in the 70s, before either of us were born, obviously. I wonder, you know, could you imagine, like, covering the church committee hearings like this? You know, like, there's some obnoxious senator who's exposing CIA assassination and surveillance plots. What a jerk. We got to hang out at CIA headquarters and look at some pretty awesome cigars they used to try to kill Castro.
It's absolutely amazing.
It's embarrassing. Not even, I mean, this isn't even like.
And it's you know. This is not like, this isn't a one off. This has been, you know, growing. 60 Minutes inability to actually do a story.
It might be time
this
to
was, this
retire.
Was, this watching this was great television. Because that's what they were making it for. They were making a TV piece. They weren't doing any reporting here. They weren't doing any journalism. They weren't trying to find things out. They weren't trying to present both sides of the story. It was a fluff piece made for TV.
Fluff piece about the NSA. Ponder on that, folks.
Amazing, yes. Oh,
so, does that take us into the better
that
half?
That takes us into the better half, where we'll be discussing... We got tons more. Well, first of all, we got to talk about Megyn Kelly. She really manages to apologize in an amazing way, which is by not apologizing at all and saying she's the victim. And we also have, we'll go into this terrible story about the drone strike in Yemen that killed 15 civilians. Also, Oklahoma GOP is trying to cut taxes that were going to go towards building a tornado shelter in an area that was just recently hit by a horrific tornado.
Well, the market can solve that.
Yes.
Also, Pope Francis responding to accusations of being a Marxist.
We also have
Chris Christie backing out of an amazing and pretty successful global warming program because, well, F you, that's why. And Rush Limbaugh probably heard the interview that Sam did with the ogling kid, and had some new thoughts that he felt he needed to share on looking at women and what's inside our DNA. So we'll get to that as well.
This soundboard is really, it's all stuff are all over the place. I was trying to find something here that would have been perfect for what you said, and it's just not. That's the sound. Sounds not there.
Well, 360 is definitely up.
Sounds is not.
All right. Well, let's, folks, become a member. Become a member.
Yes.
This is something
you can do. Go to majority.fm.
Do it for yourself. Do it for your friends. What's a better holiday gift than this?
Yes.
A subscription to the Majority Report. What's the link for Amazon? We know that you're going to be using Amazon a lot over the holidays. It's Majority Report Kickback.
MajorityReportKickback.com.
MajorityReportKickback.com. You go there, it makes absolutely no difference to you, but we get a little something. We get to wet our beaks a little bit. Follow us on Twitter. Like us on Facebook. Subscribe to us on YouTube. Write a review of us on iTunes. Obviously, subscribe Intersection, which is an amazing international relations podcast.
Just sticking that right in there.
Yeah, that was fun. By a young man named me.
Subscribe to us on YouTube at youtube.com/Sam Cedar.
Yes.
Definitely do that. We're really trying to grow our YouTube as we go into 2014.
And we are.
We're about to hit 27,000 YouTube subscribers. We'd like to hit a lot more, but
let me tell you something else. If you're the type of person, I know some people don't always enjoy like the libertarian calls or whatever, but I think most of the audience actually loves that. And they really enjoy when we interview these horrible people. The YouTube comment threads will give you a nice – if you're not looking at our YouTube channel, the comments will give you a little dose of that poison that you like with those libertarian segments. So do any and all of those things. We'll be right back in the better half of the show.
Thank you.